Today on Political Rewind, Georgia's first black senator in modern times has died. We'll look at the enormous impact civil rights champion Leroy Johnson had on the state and Metro Atlanta. A new applicant for Johnny Isaacson's Senate seat wants to forgive all student loan debt, and the partisan mood in Washington grows uglier. Political Rewind starts now. Glad to have you with us for this edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Let's meet the panel right away because we have a lot to talk about. AJC lead political writer Jim Galloway is with us. He, of course, writes a column for the Wednesday and Sunday edition of the paper and oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Usually by this time on Friday, we know what your Sunday column's going to look like, and usually it's posted on the web by now.
It already is.
What can people look for?
This is why you should worry about U.S. diplomats being called part of the deep state.
Oh, all right. Okay, so that's probably going to come into play during our conversation today.
So.
Jim Galloway, thank you. Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, Decatur representative, is with us today as well. And back pretty recently from your favorite time of the year, the New Yorker Festival.
It's such a cool place to be. I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, we're glad you're back to be here for Political Rewind. Amy Steigerwald, political science professor from Georgia State University. I know where you were until probably about 10:30 or so last night.
Yes, indeed.
You were watching
the Kings have
our
become legends.
Guys, Atlanta United,
yes,
win 2-0 over Philadelphia. They're moving into the conference championship game.
They are, and the next game will be a home game.
Yep.
And if LAFC loses the cup, and we win,
yeah,
the cup will be a home game.
Yeah. We may have some teams here who aren't very good at winning, but Atlanta United is not having that problem.
Exactly.
All right. Sam Olens is also with us. He, of course, former state attorney general before that, longtime chairman of the Cobb County Commission, and now a partner at Denton's, the world's largest law firm. Hi, Sam.
Good afternoon, sir.
Thank you for being here. All right, let's get right to it. Jim Galloway, we're going to start a little differently today. There's so much partisan back and forth. It's getting nastier and nastier out there. So let's start by talking about somebody who in many ways was a champion of many of the things that we all believe are right and good about who we are as people. Leroy Johnson. He passed away at age 91. As I said in the opening, he was the first black state senator elected to the state Senate since Reconstruction. And that's just the start of the ways in which he had made breakthroughs in our life here.
Right. This was kind of the dawn of desegregation in Georgia. So it was very much at the front end. He was elected at the same time as Carl Sanders,
1962.
It was elected governor, and they were kind of there was something of a match there. Sanders was first. I think it could be our first governor who supported integration. Of course, he was followed by a reactionary,
Lester Maddox. Yeah.
But he and Johnson came on at the same time. They formed a very, very quiet team.
Yeah, we're going to talk about it in some depth in a couple of minutes. But Leroy Johnson, a Grady baby, he was proud of that, and he was very proud of the fact that he was a Morehouse man.
And probably people would remember him most as the man who probably saved Muhammad Ali's career.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We'll get into all that. Let's do this. The first thing I'd like to do, and then get everybody to weigh in on this, is in an interview that he gave a number of years ago, Leroy Johnson talked about what it was like when he came to the state Senate as the first black senator in 1963. It would have been January of 1963. And in a very moving way, he describes how he would walk down the halls of the state capitol, try to be cheerful, say hello to all of his counterparts on both sides of the House and Senate, and no one would talk to him. No one would ever acknowledge that he was there. And then he walked into a committee meeting one day late in the session where there was a vote on an important issue, and the folks in the committee were tied on what to do about the measure. And Leroy Johnson picks up the story as he walked into the room. Here you go.
When I opened the door and walked into the room, the senators who were at the table and had voted for and against the bill jumped up. The senators who had not spoken to me for the whole session ran over to the door and grabbed my, actually touched me, and say, "Senator, I need your vote." And for a moment, I wonder what happened to my blackness. Those senators who actually touched me for the first time and spoke to me for the first time had asked me for my vote in order to get the bill that had come up and was a tie vote out of the committee to go on the floor. And I stood there with a moment of grace, and I said to myself, if I did know how important the vote was, I know now.
What do y'all think when you hear that, Mary Margaret?
It's a lovely story. Yeah. And politics is about votes. I say that all the time. I joined the Senate in January 93, and Lieutenant Governor Howard had a ceremony that day to recognize the class of 63, which included President Carter, Rex Fuqua, Mr. Fuqua, Carl Sanders, and Leroy Johnson. It was wonderful to kind of be on the side of the halls and see these gentlemen there that day. And the affection they had for the Senate, for each other, it was very much a lesson in old school civility, which had to be changed for Senator Johnson. I also had a case with Senator Johnson at some point. So I followed his career closely. And he was a very important figure.
Yeah. You know, Sam, when Leroy Johnson says in that clip, I knew how important the vote was, he wasn't just talking about a committee vote. He was talking about the civil rights struggle for black Americans to win the vote.
But, you know, and I've been reading some articles this week talking about the senator. And once again, it makes you proud because unlike some of our sister states, our state was much, much better in the desegregation of numerous services and the ability for a new governor and a new state senator to make huge change around our state and to do it without water cannons and state troopers.
Yeah, Jim Galloway wrote an article, Amy, back in 2008. You reposted it today on the AJC website. And Amy, he points out that while Leroy Johnson was getting his opportunity to serve in the Senate and accomplishing some of the breakthroughs I want to talk about in a minute, this was George Wallace was in Alabama holding the door against integration in the schools, in the university, and there was a bloodshed on the streets.
Most decidedly. And so one of the things that is really noticeable in Georgia is, A, that a lot of these steps were taken. And also one of the things that was also in Jim's article was the role of Woodruff in helping this through and the business community. And that was one of the things I'd heard previously Ambassador Young give a similar story about how one of the things that really aided in Atlanta was that a lot of the business community said, no, we're not going to have these same fights. We're not going to put Georgia in this. We're going to integrate, and everybody's going to get in line.
So, Jim, I love what, you know, what Amy sets us up for. Number one, when Leroy Johnson arrived at the state capitol, this was still a segregated facility. There was a white water fountain, a black water fountain, white bathrooms, black bathrooms, clearly marked, and the cafeteria for...
Two lines?
Well, apparently the blacks weren't even allowed in the state.
And there was a small DMV office in there, too, mm-hmm. with two lines.
How did and Johnson went about changing that? What's remarkable about it is today in the era of social media, you could never do this. He started making those changes very quietly.
Quietly. What he did was he had some interns working with him, and he said he started them using the white water fountain. And, of course, you had your Capitol guards do a quiet freak out. They phoned the governor. And that put it in Carl Sanders' a corner. And what you got to remember is then we have a powerful governor now. Then he was far more powerful. He named the Speaker of the House. He named all the committee chairmen in both chambers. He had everything at his fingertips. And Carl Sanders decided that the time had come. And he quietly, the signs disappeared.
Overnight. You walked into the Capitol the next morning, the white and black signs were gone, and Carl Sanders had just ordered it done. It's a remarkable story.
It's a remarkable story. And the politics of the Capitol today over who controls what floor and who controls the two-headed cow and all the competition that who controls this particular demonstration, we still have a lot of conflict about that. And it demonstrates, again, Carl Sanders' power and his sentiment in many different ways. Senator Johnson would simply show up someplace in the cafeteria. I love that story when he just went to the line.
And the Capitol Club. Was it the Capitol Club?
It was the Commerce Club. But before you even get there, let's pick up on what Merrick Marcus said. He walked into the Capitol cafeteria, and they said, "You can't come in here." And he said, "Well, I'm a state senator. I'm going to have lunch here."
He said, "Call the governor."
He said, "Call the governor."
And everyone, he was able to come in. He sat down with one other legislator and all the white people and all the only people. They left.
He
had successfully, Sam, integrated the
Bill, more than 10 years ago, when Senator Johnson was telling me that story, he closed it off with a different thought. And that thought was, that's when I learned that you don't get the power you deserve. You get the power you earn.
Oh, that's a great way of saying
and
it.
And it was, and what he also learned was that confrontation wasn't always the only way to go about it.
You know, you get that, Sam Olens. Mm-hmm. I mean, because that's what your career as a political leader has been. You get the power that you earn, not the what you deserve. And Leroy Johnson really was an example of that. The Commerce Club story that's so remarkable is at the end of the legislative session. I don't know if it was that first session he was in or a subsequent session, but they had a meeting at a luncheon at the Commerce Club, which, of course, was then segregated. And Leroy Johnson showed up and said, "I'm coming. I'm a member of the state Senate." And they said, "You're not coming in here." The maitre d', whoever, refused him.
They took his plate away. Plate and his silver away. And I interrupted. I love this story, though. And the call went, again, Commerce Club, governor calls
Robert Woodruff.
He is the founder or the chief executive of the Coca-Cola company.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just for
and Robert Woodruff says, "Give me 15 minutes." And the plate was brought back. The silverware was brought back. The luncheon continued. Nothing was said.
All right. I mean, that's a great, great story. One other quick story before we move on. Another thing, you said it, that he is going to be known for is we all remember that Muhammad Ali, who had become world champion at a very young age, was stripped of his titles when he refused the draft. He would not enter the Vietnam War. He wanted to get back into boxing. There were no states that wanted anything to do with Muhammad Ali because we're at a polarized time, maybe not unlike what we're living through right now. And it was and when Leroy Johnson, through a friendship with a friend of Muhammad Ali's, was given an opportunity to see if they could reinstate Ali's boxing license here in Georgia, Leroy Johnson went to work to do that. Let's listen to what he had to say about that. Well, we seem to be having a little problem with that. But, Jim, essentially what happened is he fought for it. He said, we've got to get this guy his license.
Yeah, you had 22 states that had rejected giving Ali a license. He was, by the way, he was a member of the Nation of Islam.
Yes.
Which was another factor in this. And what's interesting in by pulling this off, this was one of the most important social events of a newly empowered black electorate in the city of Atlanta. I mean, up to that point, it was probably the largest collection of black power and black financing the nation had ever seen.
Let's go ahead and run that clip and then everybody talk about it.
Because most people said to me, "You'll never be able to do it. If 56 cities had turned them down or 65 cities had turned them down, How in the world do you think you're going to get it in Georgia? And the governor of Georgia is Lester Maddox. So how are you going to do that? Well, I believed with all my heart and soul that because I was a Morehouse man, that I could do what most men could not do. Because Dr. Mays said to us at Morehouse that if you finish Morehouse, then you finish with a different vision. Your vision is not to be, to believe that you are less than anybody else, but to believe that you are as good or better than anybody else.
Benjamin E. Mays, of course, at the time the president of Morehouse College. You know, Sam, it occurs to me that if Muhammad Ali had not gotten that license here in Georgia, it is possible that his history might be told entirely differently. He might have been the guy who was a sensational boxer as a young man, but then ran afoul of the United States government, joined a religious group that were considered radical and outlaws by many people's standards. And that might have been the only thing we'd ever think about with Muhammad Ali, if not for his getting that license.
Well, true. It's also the beauty of sports and the ability to bring people together. Right. And Muhammad Ali had that ability to clearly bring people together.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he comes to Atlanta for the opening of the Olympics.
That 1996 Muhammad Ali torchlighting. Yeah. Amy, any final thought that you want to give us before we say a fond farewell to Leroy Johnson?
It's a legacy that I think we all subscribe to be able to do both the big things and the small that really change them for everybody around us.
Jim?
You know, what's interesting is I was when I put that post up and started looking at Twitter and to see who was reading it, and Carl Sanders' granddaughter.
Oh, that's terrific.
Had read it.
All right. Let's do this. Again, we remember fondly Leroy Johnson and his accomplishments for the state of Georgia, more important for all of us as people. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way and come back, and let's start talking about politics, because there's an awful lot to discuss. This is Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, we know just a bit more now about the shape that the Democratic debate here on November 20th will take. And by that, I mean, we now know that the ninth candidate has qualified to be on the stage. It's Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. And I wonder what the impact of her presence could mean in terms of what we see is this very strong divide on those stages between the Elizabeth Warren-Bernie Sanders faction and the Kamala Harris-Pete Buttigieg. Are we going to see sort of the moderates have a little bit more impact because of this?
I think so. I think you saw in the fourth debate in Westville, Ohio, you saw Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg actually have quite the moment, and they got the best reviews really out of that 3-hour session there. And bringing Klobuchar onto the Atlanta stage, that means the centrist position is going to get a little more oomph, I think. And to me, it's interesting. Now you will have, three women on the stage. Now you'll have
Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Amy Klobuchar.
Yes.
And I think given the moderating team, I think that might be important.
Probably, Amy, if there is a more centrist bent to this conversation they're going to have, that accrues to the benefit of Georgia Democrats, doesn't it?
Most decidedly. I mean, I think that you've got sort of this middle ground of trying to show what it is of where the party is. I know one of the things we're discussing later are polls that have come out recently sort of showing how, for example, are Democrats viewed? Are they socialists or are they trying to be capitalists? And that's certainly a larger debate that is going on and how these various issues are being presented. And so I think that this is a way to sort of broaden and show that definitely in the same way that the Republican Party is not a monolith, neither is the Democratic Party.
I've been following Senator Klobuchar since the Brian Kavanaugh debates. Noticed her there. how she conducted herself, the questions she asked, and following her closely during these debates. The geography of the Midwest is very important in this election, and the fact that Mayor Buttigieg and Senator Klobuchar are both rising in the polls and emphasizing the importance of the Midwest, I think, is to a benefit of our ongoing discussion.
Sam, I've asked this on the show before, and I'm always interested in what various people who are panelists in our rotation have to say about it. I wonder whether there are Georgia Democrats, I mean, having a more centrist viewpoint might be helpful, but I wonder how enthusiastic, given the purple nature of the state, some are about having the most liberal views of the party, the Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, Medicare for all positions, how much value that has for Georgia, the independents, the swing voters there, whether that's a problem for some Democrats.
So while we talk about Amy and Pete having very good performances in Ohio, and I certainly agree, I thought Pete in particular was was excellent and certainly very, very bright individual. 3% is not exactly rising.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, let's face
this
it.
This is what Amy Klobuchar
Amy, so right. still, well, and even Pete. I mean, you know, if you're not close to 10.
Well, there's some polls that have him in Iowa well up into.
Iowa.
Yeah, in Iowa. Well
he's from
important
Indiana.
First state, though.
Absolutely.
But go ahead.
But, you know, but I still think that, look, if you're the president, you want Bernie and Elizabeth to get all the all the air. If you're a suburban Republican, Amy and Peter, your nightmare, right at that point. And clearly the White House is going to be paying attention because your comment about independence, I totally agree with. But I think suburban Republican women are just as crucial in this next election.
Suburban women, however they identify. And they probably don't identify particularly because they're mostly apolitical, but they're voters. And they do concern themselves with the quality of life issues. Mm-hmm. And reproductive rights and healthy air are very important to them as an environment for their families and their children and their own economic viability. As we've said on this program earlier this fall, what's going on in Washington is such a diversion to what's the necessity of the discussion about our presidential candidates. I don't think that most people are focusing yet, and they will be, I think probably after Christmas is when the real heat of the pending, coming soon elections will be held. That's why 3% or 10% is not as worrisome to me in terms of understanding what really will be happening in the first of 2020.
Amy, I wonder if the fact of the matter is, this is the way I framed the question before, if you're Lucy McBath, you won by a very small percentage against Karen Handel last time out. You're trying very hard to be cautious about how you walk that tightrope between being a strong progressive Democrat and being a more conservative Democrat. I just wonder if you want Elizabeth Warren talking about Medicare for all right down the street from your district or from where you are.
I think part of the issue, though, is that if we're now talking about sort of who the eventual nominee is and what's going to get played, I think it doesn't really matter who wins. They're still going to be playing ads that suggest the Democrats want Medicare for all.
Good point. Good point.
They're going to be running ads that suggest that whoever it is a socialist. Mm-hmm. I think at one point I'd found there was a great poll where from Gallup where they asked to what degree people thought that the Democrats were socialists, and the date on it was 1950. So it's been a longstanding sort of issue there in the same way that it kind of doesn't matter who's on the Republican side, right, with a lot of these ads. And so I think that is less of it. I think what's more going to happen is sort of focus on the issues that people care about at home and really pushing, because right now we're also having all of this debate because there is no real other side, right? All of the policy discussion is on the Democratic side, but at some point it's going to be the Democratic view versus the Republican view, at which point I think that's where it becomes much more. And so both sides now have to answer as opposed to this kind of internal dispute.
All right. Well, while you got the ball, let me ask you a different question. You've devoted a good amount of your time as a writer, as a researcher, to looking at women in politics. The fact that we've got Andrea Mitchell, Rachel Maddow, and
Ashley Parker.
Ashley Parker from The Washington Post, right, and Kristen Welker from NBC, four women moderating this thing. What struck me about that was I remember in the last debate, the Ohio debate, at one point Kamala Harris talked about reproductive rights, as she described it, and said we've gone this far into like three, four debates. I think that was the fourth debate, and nobody's been talking about reproductive rights.
And that
four women moderating? I think women's issues may rise to the fore, yes?
I think it's very possible, because that particular issue has gotten a lot of pushback from people about the topics that are being asked about, especially of those that care, that voters really do care about. I mean, to be perfectly blunt, many more voters on both sides of the aisle vote on issues like reproductive rights than on a lot of things they've been asking about. And the fact that it hasn't been asked is a huge issue. I also think, if I could just real quick, you've also got a couple of new mothers on that panel, particularly Ashley Parker and Kristen Welker. And I think that could be an issue that comes up there as well, because this very real issue of childcare, of dual income families, of what it means, right, for people to be able to succeed and to be able to work, to be able to contribute in society. And so I think those are probably issues we might see as well.
Yeah, I would say it's just to further on your point here, I think HB 481 could really be showcased in Atlanta next month. I think that will be a very, very sharp talking point there. The other part of this, of course, this is not the first all-female panel. We've had a couple before that. But this is the first one since the Me Too movement really took off 2 years ago.
In past presidential cycles, we have had panels with a couple of women on them. I mean, solely women as panelists. Economic equality, also the kind of issue that might very well come up with a panel of four women, Sam?
You know, I always find that topic challenging because everyone has different facts. It's one of those areas where it's really easy, if you're a statistician, to play with numbers, to say whatever you want. I frankly, candidly, was much more interested this past week in the fact that you had a spacewalk with two women than four women that would be moderating the debate. I think that spoke far more to the gains that this country has accomplished.
I saw Mary Margaret's. I just saw the hairs on the back of her neck, right?
Me too.
There was a small grimace there. You said it's not factual. There's no factual consensus that women are not doing as well in the economy as men. I do believe that is an undisputed fact. Women do make less money. They do have the reality in every real-world analysis of carrying most of the burdens of the family, caring for the elderly parents and the baby getting to daycare. I'm very heartened that there are four women commentators and three presidential candidates on the stage. And the family issues for the Kurds and the Syrians and the children in cages on the border are issues that are very visual, very topical, and very important as we move into a real discussion of what is our international policy in the mess and the chaos that is created by the Trump.
And, of course, we wouldn't want to mention that the cages started under the last president and not the current president, would we?
Yeah, I get you. All right.
Though leaving that, could be interesting, though, is to see whether or not we finally get some questions on some level that are actually about issues that the president has power over. A lot of the questions have been asked about things that the president really doesn't play a role in. They don't introduce legislation. They don't pass legislation. They can sign it. But we haven't had a lot of questions about foreign policy. We haven't had as many about executive power and reach of executive power. What will they use executive orders on? And so that could be interesting.
Jim, here's the thing. I think it's probably true that, you know, 481 becomes an issue when the debate arrives. You know, economic equality, which Mary Margaret believes is a really important issue, so do many people. I mean, here's the problem with those. Who on that stage is not going to condemn HB 481? Which Democratic candidate for president? What kind of conversation are you going to be able to have, and how do you even frame questions?
Well, the only permutation you've got there is actually Biden, but he is, he has even come along a little bit for federal funding for it. But I think the point is it will come out to the target won't be the people on the stage.
Right.
The target will be the people who are listening and who are watching.
Right. Right. Okay. Yeah. The other thing we don't know yet, Jim, and I was kidding with your colleague Greg Bluestein the other day, the riddle right now is what's an issue that only political junkies and people who cover politics are interested in right now? The answer is where they're going to stage the Democratic debate.
We still don't know. I get the feeling that the news about the moderator was kind of a bone that was tossed to journalists just to keep them give them something to chew on while they tried to figure the other one out.
Sam, you got some place up there in Cobb County? You're still a Cobb County, isn't
it? Kennesaw State, maybe?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, why am I here? You know, what I was going to comment on differently.
Go ahead, comment on what you want to.
You made a comment about executive action orders. You know, under President Obama, everyone said, oh my God, what happened to the rule of law? He's issuing all these executive orders. Well, now you have President Trump doing just as much, if not more. So when you have dysfunction in Congress, the president might not write the laws. But boy, do they take advantage of that executive order. And I think as Americans, we have we've permitted the presidents to have excessive power.
Which gives us a great transition to talking about what's happening this week, particularly with regard to Georgians up on the Hill, to the impeachment probe. I think, Mary Margaret, you could take what Sam just talked about and say, well, exactly. That's why the Democratic House is now conducting an inquiry to find out, to assert their power in holding the president accountable for his actions.
Congress is dysfunctional. Mitch McConnell's, let's start with Merrick Garland, the most shocking exercise of congressional dysfunction I've seen. And the movements that are happening this week, highlighted by the quote-unquote frat boy storming of a committee room where they were actually, many of them were authorized members of the committee, was a real demonstration of how low. Each day it looks like it's getting a little lower, but the frat boy storming of a committee room, holding up their phones, was one of the new lows for me.
What did you think when you saw that, Sam? And let's put it in the Georgia context. There were three Georgia House members, Republicans. Jody Heiss was there, Buddy Carter, and Rick Allen all went in the room. It's important to point out that Jody Heiss was already a member of one of the committees that's conducting the hearing, so he didn't have to storm the room. He was already welcome inside and could ask questions.
So there's two processes occurring here. There's the legal process and the political process. It would appear that the House has the legal authority to do what they're doing, and it would appear that the Democrats are getting very nervous about the political view. And I think that's what a group of Republicans did earlier this week that you're referencing. You know, I very much respect Judge Napolitano. For those that read his opinions, he's been very critical of the White House on this issue. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing here, this is a reaction to the Mueller report, where Republicans for so long were able to control the narrative as that was released. And I think this is a reaction by Democrats in the House to say, we're not going to let that happen. We're going to control the narrative as long as we can.
Yes, but Amy, the Democrats are also starting to be clearly concerned about, you know, they have all sorts of reasons that they can establish for why they're doing this behind closed doors, in the same way that Trey Gowdy, when he conducted his Benghazi investigation of Hillary Clinton, did it all behind closed doors until he finally opened it up. But we're not living in the Trey Gowdy world anymore. We're living with a President Trump who doesn't need a war room because he goes out and stands by the helicopter every day and gets his message out loud and clear. And the message that he gets out, and Republicans like David Perdue, who yesterday was one of the signatories, one of the leading sponsors of the measure in the Senate condemning the impeachment inquiry, they're responding to the fact that Democrats are continuing to meet behind closed doors. And I think Democrats are starting to feel like, it's true, we're going to have to open this up at some point pretty soon, or we're going to lose some people to this other narrative.
from what I've seen, I think there's differing points of view on that, in the sense that part of the reason that they say that they're doing this is that they're still trying to just simply gather facts and gather information. And there's concern about whether or not witnesses are getting together ahead of time and trying to get their story straight. And so that's part of what's going on here. And I think we saw that in the suggestions, for example, that they might have to bring back Ambassador Sondland after they had interviewed Ambassador Taylor. And so I think we see it's
because
they
are now saying that Sondland may have misled them in terms of the way he answered.
Misled or, as he's now saying, did not recall certain things of information that's coming up there. I think the other issue that's really difficult here, and I would agree that the Democrats have been terrible on explaining this, is that impeachment is not, in fact, removal of the president. Yeah. The impeachment process that's going on in the House is more akin to the indictment of someone for a criminal charge.
And so
it's a grand jury. It is, in fact, simply the investigatory party. The defense is not in that. And then it has to go over to the Senate and do sort of a full airing. When it comes to the Senate resolution, in some ways, what, in fact, was most intriguing about that was two things, really. The substance of it was only about the process. There was not, in fact, anything about whether or not the reasons for conducting the inquiry were problematic. So that's notable. The second one is that they didn't actually have unanimous Republican support for it. And they also weren't able to get any Democrats on it. And so that is, I think there at least is some indication, or some people are suggesting, that this might have been as much a signal to Trump of, be careful, you don't have as much support as you think that you do. And so now we need to, you know, sort of address that.
David Perdue, Mary Margaret, as I throw it to you, tweeted about the impeachment resolution that they had in the Senate. Let me see if I can find it here. Essentially, it was you know,
called it illegal, I think.
Yeah, here we go.
Well, it's not illegal, as we know. And we also know that David Perdue is going to be predictable only on one message. So what he says is not totally relevant to me in terms of he's playing his political role on behalf of the president.
Let me interrupt long enough to say Speaker Pelosi and House Democrats have abandoned decades of precedent and denied basic due process rights with their partisan show trial. Go ahead.
So that's the kind of language he uses. It's 100% partisan. It's 100% for the president. It's predictable. And so it's not particularly...
Well, where isn't there a partisan message going out from either side?
I think
Mary
if you look yesterday at the New York Times, front page of the New York Times, it's a picture of these children with their heads coming out of some kind of jail cell saying, what's going to happen to us? And if let's go back to, when are Georgia voters going to start paying attention to what's happening in Washington? Right now, they're turned off. My view is they're turned off right now. It looks awful, awful, and it's not illuminating anything new. But sometime soon, the disaster and scariness of what the president's quote-unquote foreign policy is, tweeting and pulling troops here and there, in our strong military state and in our thoughtful voters, is going to become much more relevant to the central inquiry of, can this man in the presidency, this gentleman in the presidency, continue to serve us without really endangering our national interest?
But Sam, I think it would be fair to argue that one of the reasons that people aren't paying attention to what might be more basic issues that Mary Margaret illuminates, that Amy talked about a minute ago, is the fog of war, the partisan war about impeachment, about the abuses alleged by the president, about Democrats abusing their power. I mean, it covers up everything else that people might want to hear more about.
Look, can we not just be straight enough to acknowledge that both sides are hypocrites? I mean, that the fact of the matter is, if you look at the time where President Obama didn't know the mic was on and said to the Soviet, to the Russian, you know, after I win re-election, I can do some deals with you I can't do now. Okay, imagine that was President Trump who said that. Next day, impeachment inquiry. You know, we live in a world where everyone says what they want to say for partisan real reasons and, frankly, disregards the needs of our country.
I'm not going to disagree that we're in the age of moral relativism. but I would say that when Obama had that mic on and it was still live and he said I can do some deals, I don't think he was talking about personal deals. He was talking about national business.
No, I agree.
This is the distinction in the Ukraine situation.
I'm not sure that there's a distinction. The whole idea that you're going to do something for a country.
In return, he's going to do something to help your reelection.
You don't honestly think that we haven't had presidents before who haven't done the same thing about
worse? Nixon. We had Nixon kill the Vietnamese peace talks, but we didn't find out about that until decades after the fact.
And if we had known that Nixon was saying stop the peace talks until I can help.
Win the election.
If we had known that, I think there perhaps should have been an acceleration of an impeachment process. The personal dealing of President Trump, the personal dealing of his children on behalf of this business, which is totally incomprehensible to me, and one of his children is coming here to Georgia soon for Doug Collins.
Has been already here.
Came and went. Yeah. Is very upsetting to me. Of course, I am a political junkie. Now, when is it going to penetrate into the thoughts of folks out there who are totally distracted by this bad behavior of Congress? And I'm not going to say that President Trump and President Obama are equally at fault on their personal behavior. I don't think that's what you said either. But
true.
I think that the distraction of the partisanship is very demeaning to any real political thought.
All right. I got to interrupt because we've got to get to another break. We're going to do that right now and come back. We're going to look at the Senate races in Georgia and where they stand and a lot more on Political Rewind. We'll be right back. Mary Margaret Oliver, Sam Olens, Amy Steigerwalt, and Jim Galloway join me on Political Rewind today. Washington Post, Tom Faust sent me a fact check on the open mic that Sam Olens talked about in the last segment. He was talking to the president of Russia at the time, Dmitry Medvedev, and he said on all of these issues, particularly missile defense, this can be solved, but it's important for him, Putin, he means, to give me space. Medvedev replies, yes, I understand. So he says, Obama says, this is my last election. After my election, I'll have more flexibility. The point he's making, Sam, is that he wants to try to solve issues like missile defense.
It scares the hell out of me that the president would say that.
Okay. I just wanted to repeat, read what how the Washington Post reported.
We're talking about the security of this country. You don't. An election should not alter that equation.
Okay. The president will never read it because he canceled a subscription to the Washington Post and the New York Times this week.
He certainly talks about the New York Times still.
All right. Jim Galloway, some Senate developments are kind of interesting. One of them is that A. Wayne Johnson, now you all reported in The Jolt about this, or The Insider. A. Wayne Johnson is working. He's a Georgian. He was working. Running the loan arm of the Department of Education, the student loan arm, and he has now quit that job because he wants that Senate seat that Johnny Isaacson is giving up. So he's putting his name in the hat. Might not be quite as important, but he says he's going to run a platform of forgiving all student loan debt up to $50,000.
This is one of those things where a candidate's announcement is kind of burying the lead.
Yeah.
you have the fellow who has been in charge of overseeing the federal student aid program, and he says it is fundamentally broken, cannot be repaired. And most of these people are going to be carrying debt that they will never pay back.
Yeah.
And it's a $1 trillion program, and he says it needs to be fixed. That's quite, from an economic perspective, that's a pretty scary statement right there.
Yeah.
Well, and it also comes as the Department of Education just got levied with, I think, a $1 million fine due to still collecting being held in contempt for collecting student loans from for-profit organizations where the court had ruled that you should not be collecting their loans because they had been predatory.
I was in a coffee shop overhearing, listening to two baristas talking. One young man said he had $160,000 of college debt. A couple hours later, I was in my law office paying a college bill on behalf of a trustee role I have, trying to understand the bill. It was a technical college bill, and they had $500 of fees on top of a $1,200 tuition.
Yeah.
And I'm relating to what other people around the kitchen table, the political kitchen table of real world, are really worried about.
And I think, look, I think, you know, in this next year, we are having younger voters assert themselves.
Right,
and
exactly.
I think among younger voters, this is probably, if it's not the number one issue, it's certainly number two.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, I hope you left a pretty big tip for this guy who's $160,000 in debt.
I was just stunned.
But the prospective candidate was talking about a $50,000 deduction if they had the debt, or a $50,000 credit.
$5,000 credit if they'd, I thought.
No, it was 50.
Is it 50?
It was 50.
All right.
First thing I thought of was, let's take economics 101 again.
Yeah. To be paid for with a 1% increase on in the corporate income tax.
So if we add that to Elizabeth Warren's increases, I could then work for zero.
Well, there you go. Isn't that interesting? That if we, you know, here's one reason Brian Kemp may not want to give this guy the job, because it does sort of undermine the Republican arguments about Medicare for all and who's going to pay for it.
Indeed, it does.
All right. To no one's great surprise this week, there was confirmation that Michelle Nunn has no interest in running for either the David Perdue or the open Senate seat. She seems quite happy and, from all accounts, to be doing quite well running CARE, one of the world's most important relief organizations. Yes?
God bless her.
But let me say, if I can, she used some interesting language there. She said she was deferring any decision. Mm-hmm. And that brings a little wrinkle in this in the race for Johnny Isaacson's seat. And that is that there are going to be two contests. There's going to be the November 2020 contest, probably followed by a runoff. But then whoever wins is going to have to stand for re-election
in 2022.
Right? Mm-hmm. And that could be a race she's got her eye on.
Okay. Meanwhile, Doug Collins, who did throw his hat in the ring, Jim, had a visit from Donald Trump Jr. They were up in North Georgia at a shooting event, I think.
At a skeet shooting event and a little gab fest. 100 people showed up there, maybe. And just hours earlier, of course, Doug Collins had put out a tweet that vociferously backed the President Trump's objections to the impeachment inquiry.
Yeah, you know, and Sam, that raises a question I wanted to. I mean, you don't have to defend all Republicans on the show, and quite often you're very candid in not defending either side. But the president on Tuesday tells Republicans on the Hill, get tougher in defending me. Come on, you know, you're not being strong enough. Then he has a meeting with some of them at the White House, and apparently that's the same message he gives them then. And the next day, you have the insurgent group that rushes the skiff to try to get inside, with some of them with their cell phones. And you have Doug Collins, who has been a fierce defender of the president for a long time now. Nevertheless, he sees he's got to get back in the game. What is the optics of that?
So Count Me is one of the individuals who's actually sick and tired of the process or lack of process in D.C. I actually would like there to be an agenda. I actually would like to talk about infrastructure. I actually would like to talk about things that would improve our country. And zero of those things are occurring.
Yeah. Isn't that what Nancy Pelosi kept urging her caucus on the House side? Mary Margaret, she was very reluctant to get into the impeachment business, finally persuaded, presumably, by the whistleblower talking about Ukraine. But I can't help but wonder if even at that point, in her need to appease growing concern in the caucus, there are nights when she wakes up and thinks, why did I give in to this?
Well, we're in a bad position. She's in a bad position. Everybody's in a bad position. When you're the President of the United States calling the State Department, very respected gentleman, human scum. That's where we are. The President of the United States is calling Talbert human scum. And I can't get over that. That's probably a problem for me, my personal walking around life. I can't get over that. So Nancy Pelosi has said many times, the facts are dictating what I have to do. And the facts are political, but they're also real. Is Rudy Giuliani going to be able to keep a law license? Is he going to be indicted? He has disappeared off television. The facts of what happened in, under the supervision of Secretary Pompeo, who recruited Mr. Talbot.
Taylor, forgive me.
It's just incomprehensible how we can manage foreign policy and have any respect for the politicians in Washington that are supporting some of the facts that are undisputed that I know about today because of many different activities that some of which are partisan and not all of which are partisan.
Well, and if I could also say, I mean, when it comes to Congress and doing stuff, the House at least has passed over 300 bills, including two different ones that they passed yesterday, and they're not actually being brought up. On the other side, right, the Senate has also been doing work. For example, they confirmed another nominee on Wednesday to the federal district court. That brings them, I think, now to 151 that have been confirmed during this period. And so, I mean, there actually is a lot of work going on.
Then we have to add to this the fact that, to some extent, the media is complicit because the media focus is clearly on the war that goes on in
exactly, and they're not following the fact that there is work going on.
We are almost out of time, but you're a data geek, Amy Steigerwald, so I want to get your reaction to two quick questions from the PRRI annual survey of American values. Just came out this past week. Here's one of them. This hurt. We made you wonder about Democrats. The other one is about Republicans. Perceptions of the Democratic Party as capitalist versus socialist by party. Forget about party affiliation. Among all Americans, 53% say the Democrats are trying to make capitalism work for the benefit of the average American. But 44% say the Democratic Party has been overtaken by socialists. Now, of course, party, you know, linemen on that. Republicans are weighing in heavily on the other side. But still, and here's the other one, perception of the Republican Party as protectionist versus racist. Mm-hmm. The Republican Party is trying to protect the American way of life against outside threats, 50%. Mm-hmm. 48% say the Republican Party has been taken over by racists. So everybody's message is getting across about the other side is what this says to me.
It really is. And I mean, what I was really struck by in the poll was how divergent the views were, particularly between Democrats and Republicans on every single question. Yeah. There wasn't agreement about what are the important issues. There weren't agreement about where the policy are. I mean, it really does show that we're living in this time where polarization has really taken us to the extremes.
And you've got a federal budget crisis looming, I think, what, in December?
Yeah.
No sooner than that, actually.
Hey, I'm going to promote ahead. This is a great research document. Let's dig into a little bit more on Monday's show.
Oh, okay.
How about it?
All
There's
right.
lots of stuff we can talk about, but that's all we can talk about today. Mary Margaret Oliver, pleasure always to have you with us. Sam Oldens, thank you for being here. Amy Steigerwald, you as well. And Jim Galloway, I'll see you Monday at 2. For another political rewind. PRRI will be on the agenda. Thank you all for being with us. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again, as I said, Monday at 2. Take care, everybody.